103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. I'm talking to Keane Murray today about a forthcoming play that he has written called The Gaps. But if you want to get in touch with the programme for a future idea, do drop us an email. It's mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. Coming up in a week or so's time is a play in Smock Alley. It's called The Gaps and it's got a segue into mental health. I'm talking today with Keane Murray. Keane is the author of the play, the playwright, I suppose you call it. Hiya, Keane.
Hi, Brian. How's it going?
Good. Tell me, what is The Gaps all about?
The Gaps follows three characters over a night in the Midlands bar, but I suppose in regards to mental health, the character of Niall is a compulsive gambler, and it really follows from the start of his life to the point of that night, and that it ends with him having the choice whether he's going to stay on the same road or take a different route.
So no spoilers, you're not telling us what choice he makes. This is all set over one night, so it isn't a kind of a build-up of, you know, his backstory. It's all condensed into a lot of kind of dialogue and action in one bar, is it?
Well, the beauty of theatre would be that I suppose we can kind of do both. It is set over one night, but it does touch on the backstory of Niall and the backstory of each of the characters, in fact, by both Sarah and Tom.
So was there a particular reason why you chose gambling, or did the story find you?
A combination of both, really. I grew up working in pubs, paid my way through college working as a barman, and a big thing I've noticed working in bars, particularly in a lot of these small towns that a lot of them have been bypassed now by the motorways, you know, that there's a huge community that exists between the local pub and the local bookies, and I think that's a subject matter that's not really touched on these days. But of course there's the personal story there as well, where, you know, I spent many years living in essence a form of that life myself, and perhaps gambling a little bit too much and a lot too much at times, and very often compulsively.
Off air it was mentioned as kind of social gambling. Is it such that people get a job and they kind of fall into the taxman taking a certain percentage of the money, and they end up going to the bookies and the bookie takes a certain percentage of the money as well?
Well, of course I can't speak for everyone. I can just speak for the character within my play and myself, and I'm not going to speak for a few people around me, but what I have seen myself is that very often it becomes a numbing agent, like any other addictive, like anything else that is the source of addiction, and it becomes a numbing agent and a painkiller. When things are wrong, you celebrate it, you commiserate it by trying not to feel by going to the bookies. When things are right, you know, you go for a few drinks and put a few bets on. When things are mediocre and you're bored, you end up opening up the phone and throwing the bets on. It's very insidious, and it can become part of your life very quickly. And you know, of course, I don't have a medical background in that. I am speaking firsthand through this as well. So
yeah, and I do want to maybe push a little bit on this, is that you're writing in the play and that's your area. You're entitled to write about what happens to the character, and you've got your own experience. But your own experience is from the other side of a bar. So there's a lot of tips and banter that goes around bars in Ireland, and it's very gambling related. It's very endemic cultural thing.
Yeah, as I said to you off air earlier, I was 15 when I started collecting glasses in a bar and started working in a bar, and I would say I was about 15 and 3 days older when I put my first bet on, my first bet on in a bookies, you know, which probably not the most, you know, probably not allowed, but the bookies was none the wiser. It becomes part of your life very quickly when, or for me, it became part of my life very quickly when I was working in a bar, and the social aspect is definitely a part of it. You know, there's people coming into the bar and there's tips going around. There's older, or what you call it, for me, there was older barmen and older, bar staff there who were putting on bets and passing their shift by looking at the phone or going in and out of the bookies. It just, you know, my late father actually said to me that I was recently considering going down the line of leasing a bar, and my late father said to me before he passed away, when I was discussing it with him, was that you know, one way to ensure that a bar does well is you know, it get one that's near a bookies, because there's people going in and out of boat each day. There's a huge social aspect to the boat, and there's a huge connection with boat that people just really ignore, I guess.
And with all that information going through a bar, if at a point after you might have wised up to what's going on in your own personal kind of experiences of gambling, and these things still happen in the bar that you work in, so is it kind of a toxic environment for the reformed gambler?
I guess it is and it isn't. You know, one of the things that you try to do when you're trying to get away from bad habits and addictions is to not surround yourself, and being able to turn away and put a blind ear to certain things, it is certainly helpful if it can be done, but that's not really how addictions work very often. So falling off the wagon or falling off the horse, I suppose, a more apt metaphor for her, does happen. And, you know, working in a bar mightn't necessarily help that. And yeah, so that's where I fall on that one, Brian.
I just listening to my own question, talking about, is a bar a toxic environment? We've been normalised with bars through Coronation Street, Emmerdale, Fair City. We see bars when we're sitting at home and we're not in them. They're very normalised into our culture and into society. I suppose my next question for you is the process of taking it from your head and putting it down onto paper. That's the job you do. You're the playwright. How do you find that process?
It's just always been part of my life. You know, from the age of 13 or 12, you know, I had a pen and a pad, and I was writing stories or writing bad poetry, as most teenagers are wont to do. I'm sure I can still write some bad poetry, in fact. But yeah, no, it's just always been what I've done, and it's how it's a source of therapy for me, for sure. I've had some issues with depression and anxiety in the past, and when it comes to it's dealing with those, very often writing can be a source of escapism, a more healthy one than putting a bet on.
Is there I know we were talking about the gambling earlier, but is there a kind of a similar high when a playwright sees his play in rehearsals and goes on stage and has opening night?
I'm not sure it's a similar high, because it's definitely a healthier one, you know, but there definitely is a high, of course there is. It is a gamble at the end of the day. You're inviting everyone you know to come see something that you've helped create. Of course, this is a collaborative effort, and the actors, Sophia, Shane and Oisin, and the director, Quiva, have all elevated this piece well above where my writing has brought it.
Has it been edited along the way?
Yeah, this one goes back a while, which is funny, because I actually wrote my last play in about an hour one afternoon, but this is about the sixth draft now, and it's still a work in progress, really. So we're hoping to have this show and seen and heard, and then bring it further for a longer run somewhere.
Brilliant. So we are going to talk to Caoimhe Mulcahy, the director, in a short while, and we're also going to dip in on one of the rehearsals, just get a little bit of sound of what's going on. But tell us, where can people catch this?
It can be seen in Smock Alley on February 24th at 1 p.m. and 7:45 p.m. And tickets can be bought at smockalley.com.
How much are the tickets?
The tickets are €10 and €8, and it's actually part of a double header with another great play called The Terms and Conditions of Me and My Ma.
So you get two for the price of one.
Two for the price of one.
Let me recap. That's at smockalley.com. Tickets are €8 to €10, and it's on Sunday the 24th of February, and it's at 1 o'clock, kind of a matinee, and 7:45 p.m. in the evening. That's the night that the Oscars will be on, but don't worry, you won't miss them, because they're on at 1 a.m. into the Monday morning our time. Let's have a sneak a listen to a part of the play. We're going to go into the rehearsal room now. Just a word of warning, the following extract does contain some strong language, and if you are of a sensitive disposition, or if there are young listeners listening, you might want to turn it off for about 5 minutes.
So guys, for this run, let's try and keep the cues nice and snappy, but don't speed up too much. Try and stick to the script as much as you can. If you think you're going to paraphrase, have a quick look down at it. Eye contact is really important. That's where we're going to get the emotion. That's where we're going to get the sparks and the chemistry and the excitement. And that'll come across then in your voice and physicality. So give it a go in your own time there, wherever you're ready.
Are you all right?
Not bothering me.
Well, now Tom's gone to bed, it's time for the difficult questions. So, why won't you play music with me?
Oh, the difficult questions, is it? So who is collecting you at this ungodly hour of the evening?
Touché.
Touché indeed.
I'm going to John's place.
John from earlier? As in, that John who comes in and out of here? As in, mid-40s John? Manages the under-14 camogie team, John? You're taking the piss.
One and the same.
Sarah, he's ancient.
He's actually a really nice guy, and he's not that fucking old.
Ah, he is.
He has it together, a job, a house.
Wife? Olivia, isn't it?
She doesn't mind.
What? She doesn't mind.
But they live together, but they haven't been together in years. Separate bedrooms and the whole lot, okay? There's nobody going behind anybody's back.
Fuck off. No, seriously, fuck off.
Now, it's your turn.
My turn to sleep with John? He's not my type, Sarah.
No, you know what I mean. Why won't you play with me?
Jesus, I'm not sure I can match that revelation. I'm not interesting. Your thing is interesting.
It really isn't.
Why doesn't he leave her?
Why don't you want to play music?
I fucking knew you two were at it. Do you like him?
Niall, why don't you want to play music with me?
Sarah, I haven't played for years. Do you like John, like? House owning and camogie managing, big job John. Do you like him?
I like him enough. Now, Niall, you have to tell me why.
I just don't. I fell out of love with him.
You fell out of love with music? Bollocks. Is it your gambling? I bet it's something to do with your gambling. Let me guess. You bet somebody for it. Cards or something. Did you lose your talent in a bet against the devil or something?
Close, but not quite.
You lost it in a game of pool? You gambled that you knew all the chords to Freebird.
I told you. I sold my guitar and I couldn't bear to pick another one up since.
Why? They're fairly cheap. I mean, you'd pick one up for about 100 quid. It'd be a piece of shit, but it would do the job.
It's not about the price. It's not about any of that. I could probably scrape together the money if I wanted to.
What is it then? Come on, there has to be something more. I spilled my beans, it's your turn. Come on, Niall. Please.
Fine. It's because I sold my last instrument after losing everything. And I said to myself that I'm not going to pick up another instrument until I stop gambling. I made that promise. When I played, I loved it more than anything else. I thought it would encourage me to stop.
Did it?
Did it, fuck. I'm working tonight for wages I've already spent.
Did you enjoy it?
Gambling? I don't know, to be honest.
No, music. Did you enjoy playing?
Performing? Yeah, I loved it. During... It was the only time I wasn't thinking about horses or what I could win or lose or how I'd pay back what I owed. But I had to sell the guitar to get the money to live on. And there and then I promised myself that the next time I picked up a guitar, I'd be bet free. I'm not, so I don't deserve it. That's all, see? It's not that interesting.
Why don't you stop gambling?
I don't know, why don't you stop seeing John? There's nothing else to do around here, I guess.
Well, you could always play music with me.
I don't think so, Sarah.
Niall, what's the worst thing you've ever done?
You go first. And if mine's not worse than yours, I'll tell you.
You promise?
Yes.
Well... I am sleeping with a married man while his wife sleeps upstairs. That's fairly bad, isn't it? Like I said, they're not speaking anymore, but they pretend they're the Brady Bunch. And I know the woman, and I can see that it's killing her. I don't know why I keep doing it, but I do. Now, you go.
I said I'd tell you if mine wasn't worse. Mine's way worse.
Worse than that?
Way worse.
It couldn't be. Go on, I told you.
Mine isn't one thing, Sarah. Mine is my life. I've robbed from everyone in it. Everyone that has ever trusted me. It started out as loans, but loans I granted myself. Hands in wallets, purses, everywhere I could fit them. I've made more promises than a politician, and I've kept fewer. I've broken homes, lost friends, and I've forgotten it all by staring into a screen that gives me a buzz. I did all that, and I knew what I was doing, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't ever stop. And then I had the balls to feel sorry for myself. How dare I? Really, how fucking dare I?
You've an addiction.
And I'll do nothing to get well. The Monday Club will always be here. This little town in the middle of Ireland will always be here. And you know what? They're all like me. John, Tom, even you. We are all willing to slit our throats in an attempt to feel anything.
Great, lovely job, guys. Yeah, really nice listening going on there. Lovely.
That was intense.
Yeah, I suppose it was. That's towards the end of the play, that scene that was being rehearsed there. So it, we're getting close to the crescendo of the characters, and both the Sarah and Niall characters are kind of meeting, as I said earlier on about the road, and they have the choice of which road to take. They're kind of meeting at the point of the fork in the road there.
That's the voice of the playwright, Kian Murray. And now we're joined by the director, Caoimhe Mulcahy. Hi, Caoimhe.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'll say the same thing. That was intense.
Yeah, it is. At this stage in the play, it's late at night. They both have had a few drinks. They're both feeling a bit looser. They're very open. They're just the two of them. They're very comfortable with each other. But they both have a wall up. They both have a facade, and they're both hiding things and, I suppose, not facing up to the reality that they're living in. They don't want to deal with things. And I think at this point they recognise a companion who relates to them, who they can connect to. And that's what they do at the end.
Are they kind of mirror reflections of each other?
I don't think they're mirror reflections. I think they're very, very different things going on. From Niall's point of view, his relationship with gambling is coming from himself. It's internal. Whereas for Sarah, it was her father who was a gambler. So we're seeing both sides of how it affects people. People that are in it and people on the outside, friends and family or loved ones. But they are mirroring each other in the sense they're both fed up. They're both unhappy and they're finding something else. As they say, we'll slit our throats to feel anything. They want to feel something. They're frustrated and they're stuck in their lives, yet they're not doing anything about it.
How hard is it to direct for Kian?
It's great. He's very, you know what, he's very open. He allows me to get my big red marker and go through it and tell him what I think works and what doesn't. He's coming at it from a writing perspective, and I think that's what he does the best. The dialogue and the characters and their relationships are fantastic. It's great to have so much in the words. And then for me, the exciting part is actually getting it up on its feet, because when you have the practicalities of being in a space and moving it, moving the actors around, furniture, and having all of those stagecraft elements, it changes it. Sometimes like that, something might sound great on the page, but then when you get it up on its feet, it mightn't work, or it might be even better. It might have a whole new life to it.
There's a great pace to it. Have you spoken with the actors about the subject matter as a whole, and are they kind of bought into what's going on?
They are. We've talked a lot about it. We've done a lot of, I suppose, character research, where we sat down and figured out what is going on with these characters. What's their intention? How do they feel about each other? Where are they in the space? Are they comfortable in the space? Are they uncomfortable? I think the energy of a Midlands pub is very relaxed. It's very slow. It can be very calm. And we want to have that without it being lethargic, because it is still theatre at the end of the day, so it needs to be energetic. We need to reel the audience in, we need to draw them in, and then once they're invested, we can take our time and we can tell them a story.
For you, having a listen to it there, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's always nerve-wracking seeing it go from page to even rehearsed stage. But my thoughts are that, as I said to you earlier, I just firmly believe that Sophia, Oisín, Shane and Caoimhe are really elevating the scripts above my writing. I really enjoyed that as a whole. And, you know, the pub can be many things. The bar can be many things. And I think that's really demonstrated from... the point of view of both characters there. It can be a place where camaraderie and you find people of similar interests, but it can also be a place to open up your heart, and it can also be a place where emotions just run a little bit wild as well. And seeing that in the rehearsal room really shows me that Caoimhe and the rest of the cast have got the essence of it.
Can I ask you maybe finally, in acting and in the whole theatre industry, is there a huge bond between cast and crews as they do work? And does those bonds really kind of forge strong relationships?
Yeah, I think so. I'm really, really lucky with this group of people. I've worked with them all previously, and we auditioned for the parts. And I primarily myself, I'm an actor, so I've been in a lot of rehearsal rooms. And I thought, oh, I'll do some icebreakers to... you know, get things going. But we were really lucky that everyone was just on the same page from day one. Everyone knew where they stood, everyone was invested, and everyone gelled really well. And I think a lot of the time you do get very close to people because you're working in these intimate scenarios and you're talking about emotional subjects, and as an actor you're putting a lot of yourself into it. And I think Once you've set up a safe space that people feel in the rehearsal room, they can explore, and they can. Everyone wants the best thing at the end of the day. So, yeah, it can be great. It can be a really, really thrilling experience.
The very best of luck in Smock Alley. Can you just give us the details of tickets again?
Yeah, no problem. Tickets are available at smockalley.com, and they're 8 and 10 euro, and it's on February 24th. That's a Sunday at 1 p.m. and 7:45 p.m.
Caoimhe, Caoimhe, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Still to come on Mental Wealth, we have three great events this week in Dublin that you can go along to. Information on them coming up in a couple of minutes' time. First of all, there has been a lot of talk in the media about social media use and young people and how it is having an effect on their lives. There was the death in the United Kingdom of Molly Russell in 2017, which has been highlighted. Her parents are keeping a campaign alive to pressure the social media companies, and in particular Facebook and Instagram, who are owned by Facebook, with regard to the governance of their platform. The Samaritans have done a report, and they reported in early February about young people and the online environment and suicide. I'm going to read a bit from the report, and then I'm going to have a kind of a counter view from another report. There has been around 200 deaths of young people by suicide every year in the United Kingdom. Every single one of these deaths is a tragedy that devastates families, friends and communities. In recent weeks, the role of social media and the internet may have played in these deaths has been hitting the headlines. The government's white paper on internet safety is due for publication any day now, so it's critical for us to look at what the research says and the policy changes that are needed to better protect young people online. What does the evidence say? We know that suicide is complex and rarely caused by one thing. Research around the role of online environment is mixed and tells us that there can be both positive and negative outcomes for young people. But the current evidence can only tell us so much. For instance, there are still many questions around whether there is a causal relationship. For example, does browsing suicide-related content cause an increase in suicidal thinking? Or do people who are suicidal search out this content to seek help? We recently undertook research with the University of Bristol to unpick this further. We found that at least one quarter of patients who had self-harmed with a high suicidal intent had used the internet in connection with their self-harm. Likewise, a national inquiry into suicides by young people found there was a suicide-related internet use in nearly half of the suicides by young people every year. This isn't surprising, though, when you think that for many of us, and particularly for young people, the online world is simply a normal part of everyday life. That's why it's so important we understand how it is being used. That's an article from the Samaritans, and it's from early February 2019, looking into forthcoming legislation in the UK. In 2017, DCU did research into Pro Ana websites. Written in these scars are the stories I can't explain, a content analysis of Pro Ana and Thinspiration image sharing on Instagram. Debbie Ging and Sarah Garvey report on a study of pro-anorexia, pro-ana practices and discourses on image sharing platform Instagram. Since pro-anorexia websites first appeared in the 1990s, a growing body of academic work examines pro-ana and thinspiration communities online. However, there is a dearth of research focusing on context of new social platforms. Using a data set of 7,560 Instagram images, this study employs content analysis as to whether, to what extent and how pro-ana identities and discourses manifest themselves on a more open image-based platform such as Instagram. The authors demonstrate that the mainstream pro-ana Instagram has rendered visible pro-ana sensibilities such as the abstinence and self-discipline in the broader context of distressed girls' lives and Western culture more generally. They argue that this increased visibility may in fact be a positive development. These complex visual expressions of girls' pain and the ways in which they are shared invite more holistic and contextualized understandings of pro-ana. Unlike static websites and blogs, the more overlapping, fluid and multi-tagged nature of Instagram provides a more joined-up and multi-layered perspective on pro-ana behaviors and discourses online. These overlaps suggest that pro-ana self-disclosure on Instagram should be of interest not only to healthcare practitioners, but also to those concerned about cyberbullying, depression, self-harm, and gender equality. That's from a report from Debbie Ging and Sarah Garvey, DCU 2017. There is information being researched all the time on these topics, but right now the media is dealing with it in a very, you know, sorted out, quickly, immediately kind of way. There are nuances. I think it is something we should have discussed and debated here on Mental Wealth in forthcoming programmes. Okay, just enough time to tell you quickly about three events coming up this week. Tomorrow in TCD at 1 o'clock, the Centre for Global Health, with the support of Trinity International Development Initiative and the School of Psychology in Trinity College, Series 2, Mind the Gap, Traversing the Divides Between Policy and Practice when Working with Asylum Seekers Living in Direct Provision in Ireland. 1 o'clock TCD tomorrow. Tickets are free and on Eventbrite. Comedy Behavioural Therapy. This is an aid of turntome.org. Comedians Barry Murphy, Joe Collery, Steve Bennett. It's on Thursday night at 5:30 to 8:30. WeWork, Ivy Court, Harcourt Street, Dublin 2. Tickets are free. Donations available to be made at the event towards Turn to Me. And you can get your ticket at Eventbrite so you can book your place. And finally, if that's not your thing, around the corner on Foley's Merrion Row from 6:30 to 8:30. This is one for the ladies. Level Up, February 21st, 6:30 p.m. And Change Your Life, Stories to Inspire You in 2019. Tickets are around £12 ex VAT. Level Up is What You Look For by Girl Crew on Eventbrite. This is Mental Wealth. We're back next Tuesday at the same time. Until then, have a great week. Take care, stay safe, and goodbye.